God of all creation, of water, earth, and sky. God of all that we have. God, that all of that which we have been given. God of all of the gifts that we receive. Humble us to understand that what we have is because of your grace and your mercy. It is your land upon which we walk. It is your air that we breathe. And it is through your grace that we are given life. Help us to have the humility to receive these gifts, recognizing that all that we have and all that we are belongs to you. You are our partner. You are in communion with us. You are with us. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts honor you, Holy God. Amen. If I ever get the chance to preach a sermon for the Prosperity Gospel people, which I think is really likely, this will be the sermon I will preach. The man who came to Jesus to help him with his inheritance and settle what was apparently a rift between him and his brother got more than he had bargained for. You see, the man just wanted Jesus to settle a dispute between him and his brother and to get some financial security. Jesus sets an unapologetic boundary and says, "That's not my job. You two go figure it out for yourself." Incidentally, this is not the first time Jesus refuses to triangulate in a family conflict. Just two chapters before, he basically says the same thing to Martha when she wants him to get in the middle of her and her sister and side with her. Jesus won't give her what she wants either. Instead, Jesus uses the conflict, and this is important, I think, he uses the conflict as an opportunity in both stories to teach about priorities and values and how to have a relationship with God. Martha wants Mary to do some work, and the man wants his brother to give him some money. Jesus wants them both to sit still and listen. In our gospel reading this morning, Jesus tells a story about a man who is what we call a first world problem. He has more food than he knows what to do with. This guy doesn't squander, he saves. He's an early prototype of a modern day capitalist. Grain is in silos, and that's money in the bank. It's education for your children. It's to stimulate the economy. It's security against old age. How in the world can this man be a fool? You see, he's smart with money. He's wealthy. And then by our standards, he's a successful person in society and achieved. And yet, notice how he talks. And notice to whom he speaks. Is there anyone else in this story? Is there a family member or a friend or a neighbor with whom he shares his dilemma of his wealth? Not that we can tell. It is an internal monologue, a flow of first-person singular pronouns. "This is what I will do," he says. "I will build bigger barns, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to myself, 'Self, you have ample goods laid out for you for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.' In his speech, he does not mention any kind of responsibility to anyone else. In a soliloquy of exactly 63 words in my version, 11 of those words are I, me, mine, and self. There is not a mention of a spouse or a friend or a neighbor. Someone put it like this: this man has the money to buy a vacuum and live in it. Relax, he said to himself. Eat, drink, and be merry. This past week, I watched the HBO documentary about singer, songwriter, and piano man Billy Joel. Billy Joel was given an amazing talent of composing music and playing the piano. He had fame, he had fortune, and more than he could ever need. After his third failed marriage, he reflects while sitting alone at a piano in an unfinished house, I had all the money in the world and no one to share it with. Here I was, alone again. 8 months before Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, he preached on this text, and the sermon title was Why Jesus Called a Man a Fool. He wrote, "And so this man justly deserves this title because he was an eternal fool. He allowed the means by which he lived to be outdistanced by the ends for which he lived. This man was a fool because he failed to realize his dependence on others. This man was a fool because he said I and my so much until he lost the capacity to say we and our. He failed to realize that he couldn't do anything by himself. This man talked like he could build the barns by himself, like he could till the soil by himself, and he failed to realize that wealth is always a result of the commonwealth. Jesus says, you fool, these things you have piled up, whose will they be? When you're gone, what are they going to do? Have a rummage sale for all your huge pile of stuff? Back in the 4th century, St. Ambrose put it aptly, this rich man didn't need bigger barns. Ambrose says, if only he'd looked around at his neighbors, he would have found ample storage for his grain in the mouths of the needy. This man is isolated, and he's self-absorbed, and he lacks perspective. But I'm not sure I think that is what makes him foolish. It may make him a narcissist, but I'm not sure that's exactly what makes him foolish. What I think makes him foolish is that he didn't realize that you can never get enough of what you do not really want. You can never get enough of what you do not really want. That quote comes from a religious scholar named Houston Smith. We think we want so many things. There's an old bumper sticker that said, "The one with the most toys wins." Now, while this bumper sticker is old, the sentiment behind it is still alive and kicking. Madeline and I come from a town that is notorious, famous, infamous for its wealth and opulence. My kids will tell you that in our suburb, everyone but them got a new car to drive to school when they turned 16. And it wasn't a lemon either. They were sweet. Everyone goes to Maui over spring break and Italy for the summer. Everyone had an in-home movie theater in their basement, a cabin in Michigan, and $300 basketball shoes, easy peasy. Whether or not that was true, it sure felt that way. And there was some truth in it. And it was hard not to compare and not to feel envious or covet what other people had. What I think helped is what we would call getting outside of the Carmel bubble. It helped to work in the food pantry, volunteer at the blind school, take youth mission trips, and assist in flood relief, build wheelchair ramps, and learn about food deserts that were no less than 30 miles from our multiple grocery stores. It may have helped other people, but in the end, I think it helped my kids more. I think it helped them understand that what they had was so much. I think it made them wiser and more grateful. It takes wisdom to realize that things do not give us joy. Things do not give us joy. Things make us happy, but they do not give us joy. They do not make us complete or bless us with peace. What we want can't be touched. What we want can't be put in the bank. What we want is God. And Jesus understands that this guy is trying to slake his thirst with the wrong brew. That's how Stauffenheimer puts it when he says, money is like seawater. The more we drink, the thirstier we become. We can't get enough of what we do not really want. The famous 20th century preacher Fred Craddock told this parable. I have never been to the Greyhound races, but I've seen them on television. They have these beautiful dogs. Well, actually, they're not very beautiful. They're actually rather ugly dogs. And they run that mechanical rabbit around the ring. And when the dogs get to the point when they can no longer race, the owner puts a little ad in the paper to see if anybody wants to adopt one for a pet. If no one takes them, the dogs are destroyed. I have a niece in Arizona who cannot stand the thought of those dogs being destroyed, so she goes out and adopts them. She has several of these big old Greyhound dogs in her house. She loves them. Once, when I was home where they adopted a racing dog, he was a big spotted Greyhound dog, and he was lying there in the den. One of the kids in the family, just a toddler, was pulling on its tail, and a little older kid had his head on that big dog's stomach, using it for a pillow. The dog just seemed so happy. I said to the dog, "Are you still racing?" "No, no," the dog said. "I don't race anymore." I said, "Do you miss the glitter and the excitement of the track?" "No," he replied. "Well, what was the matter? Did you get too old to race?" "No, I still had some race in me." "Well, what then? I mean, did you not win?" "I won over $1 million from my owner." "Well, what was it? Bad treatment?" "Oh, no," the dog replied. "They treated us royally when we were racing." "Did you get crippled?" "No." "Then why?" I pressed. "I quit," he said.
"You quit?"
"Yeah," he said. "I quit."
"Why did you quit?"
"I discovered that what I was chasing was not really a rabbit. And I quit." He looked at me and said, "All that chasing, all that running around, running and running and running and running and running, and what was I chasing? It wasn't even real." The dog put his head back down so that he could be a better pillow for the little boy. You cannot get enough of what you don't really want. Amen.